We are back at the aforementioned kitchen table and back in sunny southern Arizona. The person sitting across from me is someone I have come to admire in the past year and someone that I hope to keep in touch with after leaving for college in the next few months. She's a competitive swimmer, but also a legitimate intellectual, one that was brilliant and adamant enough to get accepted into Johns Hopkins University, where she will be attending in the fall. This person is, of course, Kristen Alisea. Hello and welcome back to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book and let's begin. This episode marks our 3-month anniversary, so happy 3 months for all of you who've been listening since the beginning. Kristen and I, in order to celebrate that milestone, are going to add a 1-minute summary at the beginning of the episode. This is something I hope to continue in the future of DH and I, just so those of you who can't keep up with our reading list can still follow along. Welcome, Kristen, to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you on the show.
I'm excited to be here.
Ooh, okay. Okay, are you ready to do the one-minute summary?
Yes.
Take it away.
So, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks is an exposition novel following Henrietta Lacks, who was a African-American woman in the 1950s, who she had cancer, and because of that, she was treated, but during her treatment, she unknowingly, her cells were taken, and these cells, because of their nature, were able to be a great contribution to science and help with a ton of different diseases, vaccines, but she later died, and because there was no knowing consent, her family did not know. Even though the cells had a great impact on society, and this book follows the rest of her life after being diagnosed and the repercussions on her family and society.
Yep. It was published in 2010, and the narrative follows Rebecca Skloot's journey as she's going through chronologically researching this family and the impacts on science. As a preliminary question, I wanted to ask about genre. This is something I've been thinking about a lot in terms of this book because it's not necessarily, I don't know, what's it under?
I have no idea. I think why it's especially hard for you is because you read essentially more traditional literature and follow that path.
That's true.
Whereas this book is very, you know, it's more,
it's very non-traditional.
Non-traditional, yeah. Modern, which I think breaks from kind of both of our readings. I'm more of a fiction, but not necessarily fiction in literal importance. I'm more Harry Potter, fantasy, kind of. That's what I am.
Loader,
yeah. So I think the genre that, I definitely think it's almost a non-fictional historic novel in a sense, because it tracks, and Rebecca Skloot did so much research into the history and science of what went on.
Well, I think traditionally this might be nonfiction, just broadly nonfiction, but it has so much to do with science.
Yeah.
That's not science fiction.
I know.
It's like historical science fiction, not science-history nonfiction. Yeah, I don't know how that would play off in the Dewey Decimal System. I know we talked about that last week, but yeah, I don't know. If any of you know, just comment and we'll see.
We'd both love to know what book this is.
Yeah, it's just, it's so interesting because it's almost like a memoir, almost like a biography.
Yeah, it's a blend of so many different genres that it's hard to pinpoint one.
Yeah, but that doesn't make it any more nebulous or anything. It's super specific. It's very clear.
And especially since the narrative is done so well, it's not necessarily cut and dry. It's very beautiful what Rebecca Skloot has written about this family and what went on at the time.
Okay, well, no conclusion. That's okay with me. I forgot. I have something else to say about genre. So there's this book coming out called An Absolutely Remarkable Thing by Hank Green, which is John Green's brother. Mm-hmm. He's like the guy that did the, you know, like the mitosis and meiosis videos. What's that called?
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Crash Course.
Yeah.
Yes. So he's writing his first novel and he was trying to figure out genre. And so he has this YouTube series on Vlog Brothers, and then he also has Hank's channel, and he talks about all of the like galleys and the process of publishing a book and everything and end pages. And it's all super interesting, at least to me, because that's kind of my kind of jazz. But he was having difficulties discovering the genre of his book. And someone mentioned speculative fiction to him, and that was just like the perfect genre for his book. So I feel like there is a genre out there for this book, but we just don't necessarily know what the name is. Yeah. You know, we need an expert to tell us. So should we talk about bias, our respective biases when reading this book?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when I first saw this book, I ordered it because you told me, like, okay, let's do this book for the podcast. I was like, you know what? I'll just order it. I won't read any summaries on it like I usually do. And it came in the mail, and I read the covers. It's a super busy cover. If you go on my blog, you can see the cover photo, which will have the book cover on it. Oh, man. I was like, I kind of just, like, looked at it and groaned. I was like, this is not the book for me. Like, Kristen, why did you do this to me? Yeah. But then I actually read it, and it was phenomenal. I finished it in, like, probably 2 days. just read it. How about you? This is definitely more up your alley, I feel like.
I mean, I'm interested in science, and going to Johns Hopkins, a lot of what happened in the Baltimore area and at Johns Hopkins Medical Center. So I wanted to read it just to be informed, because I feel like it's kind of a staple if you're going to Johns Hopkins and interested in medicine. So I had friends who had read it and recommended it, and I was like, okay, it's summer, it's finally time to read it. And so I started it earlier during the summer and absolutely fell in love with it, but I needed to take a break in the middle just because it was so much all at once. But I'm very glad to have read it. I think it opens up a lot of eyes, especially in the medical world, because there are so many, I think doctors for the longest time have been revered, but with more cases like this with minority groups and then just with chronic pain, it's a reality check for them going, you need to be more careful. You aren't the god that you think you are, especially with research too, because research, I think, is overlooked and undermined.
Yeah.
But it still has such an impact on society.
And kind of unregulated, right?
Yeah.
So on Revisionist History, one of the last episodes in season 3 is called Strong Verbs, Short Sentences. And it's about Bernadine Healy and the governor, mayor, whatever, of Michigan, who was kind of the whip for all of science, if I'm using the term correctly. So Bernadine Healy was the president of the NIH. She also ran a couple of smaller labs, but she was known for being a doctor and, like, a woman and an intellectual, like, powerhouse figure at a time when women were just not allowed in science. And it's about, like, her persecution, and especially just, like, being a woman and being, especially, like, sexually. She wasn't harassed, but she was, like, verbally harassed.
Okay.
And, yeah, people would, like, put her under spotlights that weren't necessary and that they wouldn't have done if it was a man. So it's the same thing here, where she ran a bunch of research for the NIH in terms of minorities and women, and that research just wasn't as prevalent in the day as other research was.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the greatest things is because I'll often watch videos on chronic pain of popular YouTubers, and one of the biggest things that I think has hit the hardest is, you know, if men had to suffer from these problems, we would have had the answers and cures a long time ago. Just because women's pain, I think a lot of times, is overlooked, especially with, I think, one of the big things that is coming out now is endometriosis.
Right.
Which is, you know, a very painful, I don't want to say disorder or disease, but function in the uterus.
Right.
Which affects, I think, 1 in 10 women worldwide.
Yeah, like a larger percent than you would ever think.
Yeah, so just to touch on, you know, women's health and sexuality not being as addressed medical culture today.
You know, there's another podcast that I used to follow a couple months ago called Let Me Google That or something. And the woman who ran that, it's a daily podcast, which is why I unsubscribed from it. Otherwise, it was fantastic. She wrote a book about that and her, like, chronic pain. And those will be linked in the show notes. Okay, question one. Okay, I have questions for you, but you can insert your question into any of these.
Okay.
Question two. So I wanted to ask about the role of the pictures in the middle. This is a really cool book because I don't think I've ever read a book with this kind of imagery in the middle. But essentially, in probably about 4/6 into the book, there is a section with, I don't know, 10 or less pages of just pictures of Henry and his family and all of the, and her cells and just like all the history that we both talked about before this section. And there are some pictures that are relevant after the section. So I was just wondering like if you thought they were effective or not.
I thought they were very effective because I think the whole point of this book, which is just to humanize and personalize these characters to you, because I think, you know, for the longest time, and I'm going to insert one of my favorite quotes in here, one of the women who worked on her cells initially when they were first extracted, you know, just you dissociate, you're working with cells. And when Henrietta died, her husband approved a partial autopsy, so she was able to go in and collect cells.
Did he knowingly approve the autopsy, or was he forced? I forget.
He knowingly approved a partial autopsy. He didn't want the full one because he wanted to be her
at
to be
funeral.
Intact for the funeral. But this woman goes in and she says, her name is, I believe, Mary.
Oh, I know. The Mary the lab assistant.
Yes, Mary the lab assistant. And she says,
Mary Kubicek.
Sorry. She wanted to run out of the morgue and back to the lab, but instead she stared at Henrietta's arms and legs, anything to avoid looking into her lifeless eyes. Then Mary's gaze fell on Henrietta's feet and she gasped. Henrietta's toenails were covered in chipped bright red polish. And there's a section where it talks about how Henrietta always had painted toenails, which I think makes it so human to a lot of us and makes the point hit home even more that this family, there was an injustice done and all they really want is recognition. And I think inserting the pictures, you can see all the different parts of their lives, which I think is so personal and so beautiful that, you know, not many other books would do something like that.
Yeah, and the pictures just, they're in full color, most of them, and they're very clear. Everything is captioned beautifully. It's almost like a photo album in the middle of the book, and it's like, okay, I've just purchased, like, this family's, like, photo album, you know, for all intents and purposes, which is just, it hits you in a way that is not achievable without the pictures. I wanted to mention, in the middle of it, there are pictures of Henrietta's cells and the, like, people working on her cells in some lab. And it reminds me of that anecdote about how the doctor gave Henrietta's family a picture, like, a framed picture of the cells.
Yes. They gave the picture to Zachariah.
Oh, yeah, Zachariah. Yeah.
Who,
forgot.
For those of you who maybe not super interested in the book, Zachariah was her youngest son, and she was actually at the time when she was somewhat diagnosed pregnant with him and then decided to postpone treatment to carry him to term. And sadly, he went through a lot of different obstacles in his life, and by the end of kind of the journey of Rebecca and Deborah, who eventually decides to go along with her, he's a very angry, loud person, but there's a scene where they go to a lab at Hopkins to see her cells.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful scene, and you see this child and man who is so hurt and angry, and he's given a photo of this beautiful colorized version similar to the ones in the middle, and he's almost calm and so grateful for it.
Yeah, and that's something, that total shift is something that you don't, that's, you know, you can't just write that fictionally into something. That's something that actually happened. Yeah, I'm just like, I'm gonna read some of the captions because I think they're so impactful. Like, we were talking about earlier how Skloot has this very sharp way of writing and like, Jesse's just one-liners that are super powerful. Okay, there's a picture in the middle, Deborah about 13, the age when she was fending off her cousin Galen. So Deborah, her Henrietta's daughter, was sexually assaulted when she was younger, and there's this really painful, painfully long section about her childhood and all the difficulties that she faced. Deborah and her cousin Gary Lack standing in front of drying tobacco in 2001. So they came from a tobacco plantation, like their family, and they still live that kind of side of their family every day. And so that's just, that was something also that really struck me, is that I'm fortunate enough to not have to come from that background and not have to live for that every day. And I wasn't aware, you know, of how powerful that is even today.
And it's, I think the cycle of just essentially what happened to this family over and over again is so powerful that it's heartbreaking for people who will, you know, are fortunate enough to never experience that. I think it just, even Rebecca, who's a white woman, you know, mm-hmm. talked about how she was going into different neighborhoods and experiencing different things that she would have never experienced before.
Yeah, like when she went to go find the grocery store. Mm-hmm. This is at the very beginning of her journey. She goes to try to find Henrietta's family. And she ends up driving up to this grocery store in a town that she thinks is abandoned and at a point, but it's actually open. And, you know, this woman who runs it is super powerful and super amazing, but she's just in these circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the same with Deborah. You come to know and love her as a character because you've seen everything she's been through, and essentially you see what happens to her sons and her family, and it's just kind of like...
And to her, ultimately, too.
Mm-hmm. And how can... It's heartbreaking that the cycle continues to go on.
Mm-hmm. And the end, the very end, not the epilogue, but the very end is super bleak. And, you know, that's something that we should also consider with these pictures. Like, I think these pictures are kind of a vehicle for lightening up the story, because mm-hmm. otherwise it's just very bleak all the way through.
Mm.
Yeah, get some art in the middle of a big piece of art. Are you ready for question three?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, okay. This question, what is Skloot's true message with focus on the epilogue? So my follow-up question is, did she inadvertently leave Henrietta's family by the wayside in order to make a call to action for all of science? So in the epilogue, she doesn't talk about Henrietta's family.
She doesn't.
Which makes me think that this is just a book for scientists and for what she thinks should happen with science because of this incident. Or maybe as a product of mm-hmm. her research on Henrietta's family.
There's the realist side of me and the optimist side of me. The optimist side of me shows... in the book, she shows how close she's gotten with the family. And, you know, this is a very private family who's been
right.
abused by so many different sources mm-hmm. and different parts of the medical system. And the fact that they let her have pictures that are used in the book and how close she eventually got with Deborah. It just, for her to leave the family by the wayside seems impossible.
Yeah.
Because she dedicated so much of her life to this.
Right.
And to this research.
And she also founded the Henrietta Lacks Foundation.
Yeah.
With the proceeds of the book.
Which is a scholarship fund for all the descendants of the Lacks family for education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because one of the big calls for this book is that Henrietta contributed so much to science, but her family can't afford health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think Skloot definitely went aside and tried to change that.
Mm-hmm. So based on just the book, excluding the epilogue, I think she definitely did not leave the family by the wayside. The amount of research that she did, driving all over the place, and mm-hmm. she talks about how, you know, gaining debt upon student debt and using credit cards.
Oh, yeah,
and,
true.
You know, dedicating so much of her life to this, I don't think she left the family by the wayside.
But is her message for science? Like, is her message ultimately that she just wants to change the way science is gone in terms of your body's property and how that's dealt with?
I don't think she's trying to, like, directly say the message, your body is for science.
Yeah.
I think her message more is, these people deserve recognition, and what's mm-hmm. going on in the medical field deserves recognition, and is more calling the medical and science fields out rather than, I think, pushing her opinion.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I see. Yeah, I mean, because the afterword is all about talking about, it's a summary of all of these different resources with NIH and institutional review boards and American Medical Association and all of those things. And she mentioned them briefly throughout the book, but they're definitely not at the center of the book, which is just, it was just an interesting choice to me to put mm-hmm. all of that in the afterword after this big tsunami that she puts in the last few chapters. We won't spoil it for you mm-hmm. in case you want to read this, but it's a very heavy truth that she pulls in the last few chapters. And so just like changing that legislation, that's what I came out of the book with, as opposed mm-hmm. to we need to give more credit to Henrietta's family. And I think that's just because what I read last was mm-hmm. about changing institutions. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think just a counterpoint of that, she does have other sections besides the afterword. It's the where they are now, which updates the different parts of the family, what they're doing, how they've improved. And there are two, I think, great-grandchildren of Henrietta Lacks who are going to college and going to study science in order to better understand what happened, which I think, you know, is so incredible and powerful.
Yeah, and there's a cast of characters, and it ends up being, excuse my cat, It ends up being, yeah, just this kind of charming ending. Except for the afterword.
Except for the afterword. The afterword is a very heartbreaking, because it's kind of similar to the genre in that there are so many different viewpoints and so many different ways that you can interpret what the medical world is doing with cell collection and, you know, patient rights, that it's kind of like there doesn't really seem to be a solution that benefits one person. And even with essentially the outcome of what's happened over the past 50 years, it's still causing problems. So there's no right answer, which is, I think, very frustrating to readers because, you know, in its exposition style, I think kind of similar to almost Upton Sinclair's The Jungle in that book, it's kind of a call to, we need to fix this. Whereas this book, it's kind of like, this needs to be fixed, but we don't know how.
Yeah. So. Well, and it's actually kind of funny because Sinclair's book ends with a rally about communism. The last 20 pages, like, communism is the way. And I feel like this is almost the same. It's not that extreme, you know, but this is kind of like how I felt after finishing the book, the same way as how I felt after reading The Jungle, which is kind of weird. Yeah, so did you like that blog? Did you think it was effective to the end of the book, or would you have rather not had that?
I think I would have rather had it like kind of intermittently through the book, because does jump around a lot between like the time period. She does a good job of like chronologically identifying them, but she jumps from like Henrietta's life to
the present
to what happened when Henrietta was growing up, to when Deborah was growing up, and similarities and characteristics. And she does do a good job of, I think, explaining, you know, the science background and what was going on at the time. But I would have preferred to have the information about all the logistics and litigation in the book. I think that would have added more.
But what would you have rather seen in the afterword?
In the afterword, I think to help my own subconscious and my own consciousness, I think it would have been more heartwarming, more like warm, gooey stuff if she had talked about kind of like what was being done now to celebrate Henrietta Lacks and like the different places. Because I have a friend who's attending Emory, and I think they had, I'm not sure if it was an, I think it was an exhibit dedicated to her and her life.
That's
and
just awesome.
Kind of places where you could go to honor her, and then also how Atlanta has a Henrietta Lacks Day, just talk about what. Because I think the public finishes this book going, this is an injustice and I want to help with it. And just different ways to help with it would have, you know, helped our own subconscious more, because this is a book where it's kind of like meant to make you feel uncomfortable.
Right.
And kind of that call to justice, like, this is happening to minorities and everyone. So we need to kind of pick up a pitchfork and fight.
Yeah. So ways to do that. I agree with you. I agree, that would have been definitely effective, as opposed to if you're that interested, researching after the fact, you know, Henrietta Lacks, like more info on her, you know, there really isn't that much out there. And I feel like having it all in one comprehensive source would have been good, especially for the message of this novel.
Especially since, in my opinion, and this is obviously the author's bias and my bias, a lot of the information that happened prior to this book and this amount of research, because it is like going through it, this woman went to friends and distant family and close family and researchers and tracked down, I think, a researcher who was 99 in order to talk to them about what happened and to just go back, because for the longest time they did not know who this woman was. All they knew was the H-E-L-E.
Yeah, Hela. Right?
Yeah, H-E-L-A, my bad.
Healy.
And they're like, Helen Lane, Henrietta Lacks, and all these different names.
Yeah, they didn't even know her correct name, which is kind of appalling. She talks about her first science teacher, who apparently knew the correct name, whereas many science teachers at that time were calling her Helen Lane, which is just, it's kind of weird to think about. All right, are you ready for question 4?
Yes.
Your question.
Oh, this is my question? Okay. So whenever I think of you, I think of very traditional literature, as I've mentioned before. Do you think that this added to your literary experience?
Oh, in terms of prose or in terms of just?
I think in terms of prose, because you read a lot of classics. Like, do you think this will withstand the test of time, like so many classics have before, and just how it compares to kind of like other literary novels and pieces that you look at. Do you think it stands up to them?
Well, I'm going to answer this question in terms of an experience that I had. So I took a film class last year, as you are very well aware. It's all I talk about. This same question was asked about Get Out. So will it stand the test of time? Have you seen Get Out?
I have not seen it. I've read the plot synopsis for it.
Oh, yeah. That's your thing, right?
Yeah. So just to clarify for listeners out there, I enjoy movies and trailers. However, I don't find myself dedicating the time. So often I'll go online and read what happens so I know, because it'll be like, I don't really want to watch a scary movie, or there's a really popular movie out that's not all of my cup of tea, so I'll read it. And I've read the plot synopsis for Get Out, so I essentially know what happens.
Mm-hmm. And there's this scene in Get Out, and it's called the sunken place scene, where he like sinks into the chair and whatever. And that's like a super iconic scene now. And so we were asking, you know, technically and with the story, is this going to stand the test of time? And they were very like conflicting answers. My answer was yes. I think that Get Out will stand the test of time just because of the impact that it made, and it made it to the Oscars and everything. In terms of this book, I might have a disappointing answer to you. I don't think that this will stand the test of time. And this is not that I don't want it to, because I think it was a very valuable read for me. Like, I was consumed by this book for, you know, 2 or 3 days or however long I was reading it. Oh, man. Yeah, this book was a wild ride, and I enjoyed every minute of it. But this book came out in 2010, and I hadn't heard of it before you told me about it. And you're going to Johns Hopkins, which is, like, the centerpiece of this book. So it makes sense that you would have heard of it. But, yeah, it's just, I think that society needs to change in order for books like this to come out. There isn't a big enough market. Like, this is a very niche book. And, you know, like I said in the beginning, I wouldn't have read this if you hadn't suggested it to me. And I'm so glad that I did read it. But in terms of how it is presented and marketed, especially things like, please don't judge me, but especially with things like the cover, how this book looks online especially, I don't think that it will. For me personally, I will always have a copy of this book in my library. But yeah, in terms of like, I'm just thinking of comparing this to books like Crime and Punishment or Catch 22 or The Great Gatsby even.
Then follow-up question, do you think it could, because we're kind of labeling it as exposition muckraking, do you think it will stand the test of time in that alone character? Do you think it could measure up to The Jungle or to the book that I've read is Fast Food Nation, which uncovers the secrets and all the different
There's a documentary plots. About that, right?
Yeah. So do you think that it will stand out in its own little category?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. There's this book called, I think it's called Break Into the Scene. I'm not sure what the guy's name is. It's Seth something, like Seth Gordon or something. I actually saw him in person. Like, he gave a talk to a small group that I was in. And his book made it to number one in the Amazon charts for, like, entrepreneurs in, like, leadership. And I think this is the same thing. Like, it made a small impact in, like, the overall scope of things. But it made a really big impact in, like, its own little niche.
Like the science, medical.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Niche, like, I'd say, like, if you're going to be a doctor, this should be required reading for you.
In going to Hopkins, I think we're required to read a book for orientation to just as like a way, I think, to kind of like sit down with everyone, because Baltimore is such a controversial city, and just to kind of like get out feelings and hear other perspectives. Right. And the book we're reading this year, it's on, I believe, and I can let you know the book down below so you can link it. Yeah. And it's The Women Who Contribute to the Montgomery Bus Boycott.
Oh, yeah.
But I honestly, part of me thinks that this book should become a staple because, you know, if you've read it, you get to reread it, and it has so many different facets that you can look through it. And for those who haven't read it, who are considering the medical field, it should become kind of like an insight to what can go wrong and what you should be careful for.
Right, yeah. I mean, this is so different because we're going to very different areas and very different subject fields. I'm studying, what am I studying? What is that category? Not even humanities. It's like, oh, I'm studying liberal arts. Wow, good job, self. And we have to read The Handmaid's Tale because Margaret Atwood is coming to Northwestern. Ooh. Very excited. There will be more info on that later. Yeah, and so just like having read The Handmaid's Tale, which is a very different take on the same scope of issues. Like there isn't any like science or medical stuff, obviously, but it's similar in that they come from a similar bias, but different in that they're both fitting to their respective schools, which is cool.
I just want to say that I feel like we've covered a small scope of the book, but there's so much more that we could cover. And when we go through, I think, the favorite quotes, and I think it's not maybe not necessarily favorite quotes, but it's the ones that are the most pointed, that hit home the most.
Yeah.
We'll kind of talk about a little bit more, but there are so many different issues in the book.
Right.
And I think no matter what, anyone can enjoy and appreciate it, no matter what background they come from. And I highly recommend this too. Everyone, essentially.
Yeah, and I think even political affiliations, like, those are so heated nowadays, but I'm just gonna say, I'm not gonna tell you what my political affiliation is, but this is not the kind of literature that I lean towards normally, but I still appreciate it. I think that it's a great read in terms of literary elements. Like, even if you are not interested in this kind of social issue at all, this would be a great read for you just to learn more about investigative journalism, perhaps, or about how to structure a book like this. I wanted to ask about pacing.
Pacing.
This book has really weird pacing.
It does, but I didn't think about it until after you mentioned it. Because I think the pacing comes from, like, her jumping around to different places. Because I think the first part of the book, I think, was the most inconsistent. Because you're learning about what Henrietta went through, like, in her childhood and, you know, being a mom and with her husband and what she's going through while she's being treated. And then you have the author, Rebecca Skloot, trying to get in contact with the family and essentially hitting a wall every time she comes into contact with them. And I think that's the first part of the book. And then afterwards, it's divided up into three parts. It's her life, her death, and her immortality. Once you hit the second part and the third part, it becomes a lot more enmeshed because she is talking with the family more and she is including more research and different ways that the research has affected the world, which, you know, is interesting all over because it, you know, covers essentially everything from cancer research, AIDS, polio, scientific discoveries like the cells were the first cells to be sent to space and, you know, studied and just stuff like that. And so then
we know more as she knows more.
Yes.
Is the format. Yeah, it almost reminds me, not quite, it's definitely understandable and digestible, but it kind of reminds me of like a David Lynch film where it's just like all over the place and you're like, whoa. Also, I think in terms of pacing, it was pretty steady. We're talking in terms of music. It was like a slow walking tempo, you know, on Dante for the first, you know, until we get to the pictures. But then after the pictures, it was like rapid fire, like Schoenberg, like crazy stuff. And that to me was particularly jarring, especially since I'm really sensitive to pacing issues. Like The Lord of the Rings is slow all the way through.
Yes.
And then, I don't know, like maybe The Great Gatsby or something is like pretty fast all the way through because it's so short. But this is definitely more varied, and it doesn't make it less interesting. It just makes it a little bit, you have to be more active with it, I think. Okay, let us get into favorite quotes.
I don't know where this quote is, but I think the first one that hit me hard was, it was either a researcher or a doctor who labeled himself as like a vulture. And I think in the medical world, especially in the 1950s, that's just so poignant, and it's like kind of accepting the whole doctors are gods and they can do whatever they want, which my father's a doctor, and so
My mother's a doctor.
So to read that and go, oh my gosh, especially with, I think, a more popular culture, Grey's Anatomy, how some of the issues in there is that, you know, the surgeons think they're gods and everyone else can kind of deal with them.
Be swept up,
Okay,
I'm going to read the epigraph for you guys because a lot of the discussion in this book centers around the same kind of thing as the Nuremberg trials and the Nuremberg Code, which we learned a lot about in Gov. I mean, I love the Reconstruction, you know, post-World War II era because of how nuanced it is and because of how difficult it was to get through and, you know, what the Supreme Court had to do, what other nations had to do, and how it was kind of a world effort to try to get things back on track. So she quotes Elie Wiesel, which is the author of Night, We must not see any person as an abstraction. Instead, we must see in every person a universe with its own secrets, with its own treasures, with its own sources of anguish, and with some measure of triumph. And it's from the book, The Nazi Doctors and the Nuremberg Code. I always say this. This is my new favorite word, definitive. It's a very definitive statement to start this book.
Mm-hmm. All right, so the next quote is when Henrietta has been receiving treatment for her cancer, and she's talking with her friends and family members, and one of them says, "Henny," she whispered, "they burnt you black as tar." Henrietta just nodded and said, "Lord, it feels like that blackness be spread in all inside me," which is just so heart-wrenching because she had such a totalitarian cancer that spread so fast that doctors kind of tried to help fix, but it was just so advanced like throughout her body, and then I think advanced technically that.
And they did radiation treatments on her. Was it uranium or something?
I think so. And what's so absurd, just like the comparison between medicine then and medicine now, is that they sewed essentially
a big piece into radioactive
material into her body as a way to try and kill the cancer cells, which is just, you know, an abomination today. And I think shows still how medicine has been developing for its entirety.
And the other heart-wrenching part about that is after the radium treatment, she asked the doctors, "So when can I have my next child?" And they're like, "You don't understand, like, you can't have children anymore." And she's like, "Well, I wouldn't have gone through the treatments if I knew that." Which is just so sad. Next quote. As Henrietta and Day grew older, they traded Ring Around the Rosie for horse races along the dirt road that ran the length of what used to be the Lax tobacco plantation that was now simply called Laxtown. So this is just it's an idyllic part of the book in the middle of something that's so sad. And it's talking about Henrietta's childhood with her husband, Day.
The next quote I have is about, it took a long time to finally identify the family of Henrietta Lacks. And once they did, I think researchers were kind of like, we can get more samples. And that was the only focus they had it. Because for the longest time, whenever someone would call, the family would have more questions than the researcher.
Yeah.
And there was a famous geneticist who she worked under. And she was like, if he told you to jump, you'd say how high, essentially. That's how prominent he was. And in interviewing this woman, her name is Jessica Hsu. I may be pronouncing that wrong.
I think that's right.
Towards the end of the conversation with the author, she says, then she asked if I'd tell the Lax family one more thing for her. If they were willing, she said, I wouldn't mind to go back and get some more blood. Which is just so, like, so cold.
Yeah.
It's like,
especially, she knew the intent of the book that she was writing. Like, I think Rebecca Skloot was extremely transparent with everyone she was interviewing about the purposes of this book. But,
It's just so cut and dry what this researcher wanted. And she rose to prominence, and I think did do some contributions that helped big ways. But
and perhaps because she was so cold and critical. Yeah. And yeah, the point is, you don't have to be like that. Okay, next quote. This is when Henrietta Lacks, the name, first came out and replaced Helen Lane for good. Henrietta's identity would soon spread from lab to lab as quickly as herself. That also is just a very clinical description of her name, of all things. And that is what got me, I think. It's almost like identity theft. You know, someone who, my family has gone through a couple of identity theft issues, it's so damaging, you know, and even the quote-unquote smaller issues that we went through were just so total and so damaging. And having this worldwide phenomenon with her name, yeah, that just hit me.
This is my last quote that I have. So this is after they've been to the lab at Hopkins, and a very nice young researcher who is kind of sharing his viewpoint. He's like, Hopkins did wrong by you. You guys didn't deserve that. You should, you know, take action.
Right.
But they were more the family throughout the book is painted in a way that, for the most part, they only seem like wanting to know more about their mother. That's their primary focus. So this is after they've been to the lab, and this very kind researcher has kind of explained cell biology and what's been going on. And her youngest son, Zachariah, who's the one who went through all who's angry and has been through all the different obstacles in his life, it's Zachariah reached up and touched Christoph on the back and said thank you. Outside, he did the same to me, then turned to catch the bus home. Deborah and I stood in silence, watching him walk away. Then she put her arm around me and said, girl, you just witnessed a miracle. Which is just such a touching point in the book, because you see this character who is so full of hate and anger, just kind of almost relaxing a little bit, which is so touching.
Okay, I have two more quotes. One of them I was going to mention when you were talking about the red toenails earlier, but I decided to save it for right now. So it is, Henrietta had wanted to hold Deborah, to dress her in beautiful clothes and braid her hair, to teach her how to paint her nails, curl her hair, and handle men. Just thinking, I had a grandmother that died when I was very little, so just thinking about the same kind of things, like how much regret I think that is like involved in that situation, I totally understand that, and I think that's a very articulate way of describing like loss.
Yeah, and I think I had a very close family member die suddenly, and it was someone who, you know, it's like a parent figure who I depended on for a lot of things, and was just figure that was always going to be there, and having them gone at not a super young age, but still a developmental age, it's still painful, and there's still so much regret. And being kind of on the side of Deborah, it's, you know, so much could have happened, and so much could have helped that, you know, you'll just never know what could have happened.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, our last quote, hopefully to end on a more lighthearted note. I know this is a very heavy book to talk about. It is when she's talking to one of Henrietta's older family members, and he's talking about their history in slavery. And so he says, they spending eternity in the same place, he told me laughing. They must have worked out their problems by now. He's talking about the slave owners and the slaves. And I think that's just such a, like, a unique way of thinking about that whole situation. And there's so much forgiveness, you know, in the undertones, if you read between the lines in that statement. And it just, it kind of tells you how pure this family is, characterizes the family super well.
They have their ups and downs, but I think going back to the pictures, you just see this family and their entirety, and you just feel a little hopeful because, you know, they've had all these injustices done to them, but they're still there and they're still fighting and they continue.
Exactly. Okay, related reading. We're getting there.
So I think this is one of the harder parts of the discussion, because this is the most concrete research exposition on this woman there is. Like, I think for those of you who are really interested in this book, what might be worthwhile is investigating into the publications before this. So I think it was a Rolling Stones article by Michael Rogers on
there's
the family.
There's a Collier's article too.
Collier's.
Is that Collier?
There's, I think, two BBC documentaries on it. One where they interview the family, and another one that's very inaccurate. Prior to that, if you like the style, I'd suggest more like exposition style. So like Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, Fast Food Nation, In Cold Blood is another.
Oh, yeah.
Like investigative journals about like murders and incidents and accidents would be your cup of tea.
I always recommend Joan Didion, because this podcast is named after her, but Joan Didion did a bunch of really great kind of like investigative journalism pieces in the 60s and 70s, which was her. She was the queen of that era. Okay. I actually wanted to talk about The Sound of the Fury and Absalom Absalom, which is a sequel to The Sound of the Fury. I mean, you know, obviously it's definitely not as enlightened as this book is, because just because of the time period it was written in, but it's about that same, you get the same feeling of the South. And I think that Faulkner, above any other author, encapsulates that. He just encapsulates that feeling so well.
I think it's similar in the same of, it's a family who
just as dysfunctional.
As dysfunctional. And, you know, there are other, there's the primary family, because, you know, this is set in the South, so it's a primary white family, and then an African-American family who's helped out for however long, but you see the endurance of the African-American family as they continue to improve. At the same time, white society is kind of crumbling as they interact with it, which is...
Yeah, and you can, and it kind of gets, at the end of each section, it kind of gets into what the future of both families looks like, and they honestly look pretty much the same, you know, just as bleak, and I think that is very similar to this book as well. Now, as promised, we are going into bi-weekly favorites. I'm very excited. I think I can use favorites, because it's like, not copyrighted by any one person,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
I don't know. We're going to try it, and if we get in trouble, we'll just change it.
Mm-hmm.
My bi-weekly favorite is the album Bridge Over Troubled Water mm-hmm. by Simon and Garfunkel.
Mm-hmm.
I love this album so much. I bought it when I was in Houston for the Great Gatsby episode. That's not the only reason why I went, obviously. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've been listening to it on repeat for probably the last 3 or 4 days. Highly recommend. The song The Boxer is on that album. Mm-hmm. Great song.
On the topic of music, probably one of my favorites right now is, it's a musical, it's In the Heights by Lin-Manuel Miranda. And for those of you who don't know, I'm Puerto Rican, and so is Lin-Manuel Miranda. To see someone who's so prevalent in the musical society and just kind of like his experience growing up and being in a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood, it just, it touches, and then he's just such a gifted songwriter, singer, talent extraordinaire.
Yeah.
And I think some people may overlook him. Even though it's his first music, he's able to articulate things so well that I think for those of you who kind of consider it below you, not necessarily like my dad. My dad's a big like Les Mis, Phantom fan who, you know, isn't really in touch with the more modern musicals, but he was able to appreciate it.
Yeah.
So that is my recommendation, especially for anyone who's kind of like going off to college, because it has a lot of songs about change and shifting and finding yourself.
Awesome. And that's something that we can definitely relate to, especially mm-hmm. coming from here where like the minority is the majority.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I wish you a very good luck with your college move.
Thank you. You too.
Have a good time. And thank you so much for coming on the show. I really enjoyed it. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, consider checking out the last episode where I discussed the Dewey Decimal System. Everything DH and I can be found at didinandhawthorne.blueberry.net, except blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Now you can also follow the show on Twitter with @didianin. I'll be posting about new lit releases, reading lists, and of course the new projects and episodes relating to DH and I, which includes something that may or may not be happening on Saturdays in December. Also, stay tuned for the next episode in 2 weeks' time. We'll be diving into 8 books that changed my perspective forever. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Spotify, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. See you guys in 2 weeks.